Welcome to episode 12 of the Commitment to Excellence podcast. I'm Sean Quimby. I am your host. I am here to help you make a commitment to excellence in any and everything in your life that you're looking to excel at. I want to help you and me be the best that we can be in whatever it is we set out to do. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate the listens, the shares, the engagement. It's getting better all the time, and I'm really excited and appreciative that folks take the time to listen and keep giving me feedback, and especially sharing the show. That is literally the best thing you can do, to share the show. So today you're going to get, I had something a little more elaborate planned, but I have been violently ill this week. So I wasn't even 100% sure that I was going to conjure up the energy to do this, but I have made a commitment to put out at least one episode a week, and I cannot, you know, I'd have to be in the hospital or just about dead to miss an episode, and I'm not in the hospital, and I'm not just about dead. So here I am recording an episode, keeping my commitment. I'm putting in the reps to get better at this because that's what it's all about, right? It's reps over time. And this is my 12th rep. So here we go. Today's going to be another potluck episode to just, like I said, I had something a little more elaborate planned for today. I probably kick that back to next week that required some reading and some prep time. And I just, to be honest, I didn't have the mental and or physical energy to do that. So I don't like to travel. I do not care for traveling. I am a simple country boy, and I've been described that way in the past, and I'm okay with it. I like living in the middle of nowhere and staying there. However, my son is a bit more adventurous, is in his freshman year of college, and he is, he's in Pittsburgh going to college. And we went down for the weekend, last weekend, to see him. And it was a cool experience. I'm not a city boy. I don't care for cities, although I'm finding a way to tolerate Pittsburgh, even though I've only been there twice at this point. But I'm tolerating it. And, you know, he's worth it for sure. So does indoor, outdoor track. He also runs cross country, but track is his jam, which is funny because if you know me, I am a long time ago, football player, and then I was a very pretty successful powerlifter. I was on the U.S. powerlifting team in 1998, and I'm a big boy. I wasn't a little powerlifter. I competed at Worlds the year I went to Worlds as a super heavyweight, which means I was over, I think you had to be over 301 pounds to compete as a super heavyweight, and I competed at nationals that year as a 275. So I was under 275, and I think I finished second that year at nationals. And only the winners go to Worlds, and the guy that won the super heavyweight class couldn't go to Worlds. So the coach asked me, he's like, "Hey, think you can put on some weight and make super heavyweight and compete for us on the U.S. team as a super heavyweight?" And I was like, "You want me to gain like 25 pounds? No problem." So I put the weight on and competed as a super heavyweight. So anyway, why that matters is my son's a runner, a distance runner. How he became a runner, coming from my genes, I have no idea, but he's a better than average runner. But what he's really, really good at is race walking. If you've ever seen race walking, it is a funny sport to watch because they walk, imagine walking as fast as you can for miles at a time. And there's very specific form, and it's a quirky sport. And it's cool because he's kind of makes sense. He's a quirky kid. And I mean that in a very endearing sort of way. So he finished high school last year, and he really, like, he did it off and on ever since he was a little kid, and he just sort of took to it with no coaching, no real meaningful guidance whatsoever. And he was pretty good at it. So he gets to high school, and the coach at our local high school actually knew some stuff. But he got approached in the community one day at a meet by this gal who was a All-American race walker in college. And she's like, hey, I work with some kids, and he's pretty good. Can I coach him? Blah, blah, blah. So anyway, long story short, she coached him last year in high school. And he was probably number two in the state with a year of coaching, and he was ranked in the top five in the country in a couple of different distances. Mostly because of the help of this gal, but he really only had 1 year of like legit coaching under his belt. So he's nationally ranked, and you know, we were planning on him just staying local in Maine for school. He was probably going to go to like a small D3 school, NCAA D3 school here in Maine, and run cross country and, you know, see if he could find a track event that would work for him, because NCAA does not do race walking. I don't understand why, because it's an Olympic sport. But it's one of those obscure things, really popular in other countries, not so popular here. But so he went, he got invited to the Penn Relays last year, qualified to go, went to the Penn Relays, did pretty well, raced against the U.S. Olympian and the Canadian Olympian, and they blew his doors off. But it was a really cool experience, and he's like, hey, I kind of like this. So some coaches reached out, because race walking is a sport in the NAIA, and this one school in Pittsburgh reached out and said, hey, we'd love to have him come race walk for us. And I was like, well, you know, we'll talk to him. My wife and I were both kind of freaked out. That's pretty far away. We were hoping he'd stay close. And so I said, there's no way they have his major. He wanted to do something like in the film kind of cinematography world. And there was a program here in Maine where he could have kind of sort of got that. So we looked, and the school in Pittsburgh has one of the best programs in the country. So anyway, long story short, speed up, he ends up going to school there. And he's doing all right. He held his own during the cross-country season, which again is, I'm under no delusion that he's ever going to be a rock star at that. But now indoor track season's going on, and he's done okay. His first meet, he qualified to go to nationals, which is kind of a big deal. So conference championships were this past weekend, and we went down. We're like, hey, let's go see one meet. You know, this one matters. The team that he's on, they're really good. They won, but the men's and women's team both won the conference championship this year. I think it's like the seventh or eighth year in a row for the women's team, and the men's team won, like, it's like the seventh championship out of the last 8 or 9 years, something like that. Anyway, they win a lot of championships. So we're like, let's go down and watch that. So we went down to Ohio where they were competing and watched the meet and got to see him compete and see him destroy. He set his first meet of the year, he set the school record. Because they've never had a legit race walker there before. He's the first legit race walker. So the winter they do 3K. In the summer outdoors, they do 5Ks. So he crushed his school record by like a minute, 20 seconds, and re-qualified again for nationals. So he's going to nationals next weekend in South Dakota, which is pretty cool. So we got to go down and watch that and spend some time with him, go out to eat, hang out, that kind of thing. It was awesome. So I'm super pumped, really proud of him. I think it's been hard for him, small town country boy, to be in a big city this year, and that's been pretty cool. And he got thrown a bit of a curveball that we're gonna have to figure out, because I'm a little agitated about this, because there's no way when he got recruited to go down there, there's no way they didn't know this was coming. So it turns out they got invited to move over to NCAA and become a Division II school, which is awesome for this school, a small private college in Pittsburgh. It's awesome for them to transfer over to NCAA D2. That's a really big deal for everybody other than my son, because there is no race walking NCAA, and coach is telling him that they can still support him doing race walking stuff, but he's not going to have set meets. And so now he's got to talk about, see if he can, you know, or even wants to transfer, which is a bummer because he's made friends and he's doing all right there. And there aren't many other schools that have a program like his. They're NAIA schools. And so there's a lot of, like, that's a bummer. But, you know, we'll figure that out. But it was cool to go down and see him compete and have, you know, the best race of his life, really. It was a cool experience. We get back home, and the next day I'm off to work, and I'm just like, hey, I'm not feeling good. I'm just not feeling good. And as the day went on, felt worse and worse and worse, and then downhill from there. So it's been a messy week, just kind of under the weather. I thought I had maybe had acquired the C word down there in Ohio and Pittsburgh, but tests are negative, so no C word, just some other crud. So I probably, like, I know I sound kind of gruff anyway, but I suspect I sound a little more gruff today than usual. So it's because I'm sick. I apologize. But I'm here, and I'm doing it. So that's my, I guess that's a little brag about my son. I'm pretty proud of him. Hopefully someday he'll listen to this and not be embarrassed by it. Going into nationals, he's ranked like 12th in the country. Look, it's a pretty competitive indoor nationals this year. He's a freshman. I think he could, if he makes top eight, he's an All-American. He's got a shot. It's a long shot, probably. He's going to beat some kids. I think the one thing that will favor him, though, is all these meets so far have been very lightly judged. So this race walking gets judged, and if you break form, they'll give you what they call paddles, and they'll disqualify you if your form is crappy. So basically, you can't run. You have to, there's a couple of little, you have to have 1 foot in contact with the ground all the time. So if you're running, take a picture of somebody running, you'll very often see, like, both of their feet will be in the air at the same time. With race walking, you can't do that. There's some other things with how your legs have to be and whatnot. But so these were very lightly judged meets, and he finished fourth at this meet. And two of the guys who finished in front of him, their form was horrible. One of them was pretty solid. He's like a fifth or sixth year senior, which is awesome. He's just lingering because of COVID stuff, I guess. So that's not helping him out either. But no excuses, right? Like, I mean, fourth in the conference as a freshman, that's not bad. School record, he did really good. So I'd love to see him hit top eight at nationals, but really, he's accomplished more than I dreamed he would. So anyway, if you ever listen to this, buddy, I'm proud of you. Nice job. Keep working hard, because hard work pays off, right? So anyway, two things that I wanted to talk about today, just for kind of topics beyond the brag about my son. Somebody asked me the other day, if you follow me on social media, I start every day, except for if I don't do it, I start my day with a workout of some kind. And although I haven't worked out in the last 3 or 4 days at least, but I start my day with some kind of workout, and I make a post on social media about it, which some people have told me they find obnoxious, and I understand. You don't care if I work out or not. That post is not for you, though. The post is for me, just for the record. It's an accountability thing that I do for myself. I just want to have, you know, I know that if I posted I worked out, you know, it doesn't bother me that, you know, I've been legit violently ill for the past week, so it's cool that I haven't worked out. I probably shouldn't work out. There have been times in my life when I would push through that and just try to do it anyway, but I think the benefits of doing that are not outweighed by the risks at this point. So anyway, I don't mind that I haven't done it, but I like starting my day that way. It's an accountability thing, and I start every one of those posts with the hashtag Burning Daylight. And somebody asked me, what's that all about? So I thought I would explain what it's all about, just for conversation piece and interest. So here's where I got it from. when I was a kid, my dad made me watch all kinds of old Westerns, which at the time I remember not liking, but now I love all those old Westerns. And his favorite Westerns, I think you would say that his favorite Westerns were the old John Wayne movies. You know, truth be told, I liked most of them when I was a kid, but I love them all now. Like John Wayne just, I don't know, John Wayne represents so many things that I think we should pay attention to. But there's one movie called The Cowboys. So he took out, if you've seen it, you know, but if you haven't, you should check it out. So he ends up having to do this big cattle drive, and the men, I forget why, but none of the men can go. Maybe they're all off at war or something like that. I forget what it is, but the men can't go. So they've got to get these cattle to market, and they enlist all the boys in the town, thus the cowboys. So John Wayne and a couple other guys and all these kids drive these cattle to market. And, you know, he's up before the sun every day, and he's yelling at the kids to get going. He's like, we're burning daylight, let's go. So for me, I don't know, I just always loved that. It was about, you know, hey, we've got another day, and the day is wasting. Even though the sun's not necessarily up yet, like, we are burning daylight. And it's a reminder to me to value every day. And really, again, I know it sounds a little hokey, but every day is a gift, right? Like, that's another hashtag that I use from time to time. Every day we wake up, we've got another day. It's a gift. Let's make the most of it. Let's do something with it. Let's not squander. And I haven't always thought that way. I have squandered many a day. But I don't want to squander any anymore. You know, you get to be my age, or they start stacking up, and you're not getting any of them back. And I just want to make the most of every single day, which is why being sick is so hard, because I haven't accomplished much this week. But, you know, I got to get through it. But the burning daylight thing, that is a reminder to me and anybody else who wants to pay attention to it, that if you're reading it, you got another day. It's a gift. What are you going to do with it? And the day is wasting. It starts early. And that, you know, that's another reminder for myself, like, get up, get going. I was one of those people that sort of lied to myself. Maybe I've talked about this before, but that I was like a night owl and I did my best work at night. I'm not a night owl and I don't do my best work at night. And the research is fairly clear that most people aren't night owls and most people don't do their best work at night. Most people do their best work in the morning, which is why I love getting up at 4:30 now. It took me a long time to embrace that, but I love getting up at 4:30 and getting stuff done. And that gets me up early. I can get some work done on some kind of project that belongs to me. Like, it's my own time. It's my own project. I can get up, get some work done on a project, get a workout in, and still get to work where I rent my time to somebody else currently. It's just a way to get to prime the day, right? That post in and of itself is a way to prime the day and get me started. And then the burning daylight in particular. And I take it seriously. Like, every time I write that, I think about it. And it's a mindset thing, right? Which was going to be my topic of discussion today, all about mindset and research on mindset. But we're going to save that for next week or another time. But I'm priming the pump. I get up in the morning and I'm priming the pump. It helps me have a better day. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said every one of my days was awesome and I just dominate the whole thing from start to finish, because I don't. But I am trying to deliberately stack the deck in my favor. And that silly social media post that I do every morning with that burning daylight hashtag, that is how I do it. So I challenge you, do something with that burning daylight hashtag. If you want to be corny and hokey like me, like, it means something. And, you know, so its origin for me was that John Wayne movie. Interestingly enough, a friend saw that post and said, hey, have you ever read that book? I'm like, what book? Burning Daylight by Jack London. So Jack London wrote a book called Burning Daylight in, I think, 1910. And she gave me a copy of the book. So truth be told, I have not read the book yet. I'm kind of a, it's a novel, it's a story. I do not like to read novels, but I will read it eventually. But it's a book, but I did a little research. I was like, where'd that phrase come from? So interesting side note that what I found, the origins of the saying actually from William Shakespeare, and he used that phrase in two of his plays. He used it in Romeo and Juliet, and he also used it in The Merry Wives of Windsor. I've not read The Merry Wives of Windsor. I believe that I was forced to read Romeo and Juliet when I was in high school. I don't recall reading it in its entirety. Frankly, there's only one book that I read in its entirety in high school, and it wasn't a Shakespeare play, that's for sure. But anyway, Shakespeare was talking about that back in the day and referring to, hey, like, we're wasting the day here. Like, let's get going. Let's get after it. He probably was a tad more eloquent than I just was, but Shakespeare, Burning Daylight, kind of cool. So use that hashtag if you're a hashtag user. I've become a hashtag user. Again, that's something else that people have told me they find annoying is all my hashtags. But again, I don't really care. Like, I'm not doing that for you. I'm doing it for me. It's about my accountability and my growth. And there's been enough people give me enough positive feedback about all that stuff that I'm going to keep doing it. So anyway, I hope you like that. And if you've ever wondered what that Burning Daylight hashtag is all about, that's what it's about. All right. So the last thing I wanted to talk about today for our potluck episode, finding a therapist. I figure since I am a therapist, that it might be of value to share some of my thoughts about that. And it is a question people routinely, friends, family, acquaintances routinely ask me for recommendations and suggestions and who should I go see? What should I think about? So I thought I'd throw that in a podcast. And again, you know, you ask 1,000 therapists or just random people this question, you probably get 1,000 different answers. So these are my thoughts about finding a therapist and things to think about. And to be fair, I'm not sure that most people need a therapist. But I think a lot of people want one. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. Obviously, I'm a therapist. So I think the way I look at a therapist is, and I hate the, a therapist is a coach. A good therapist is a coach, in my opinion. They are going to coach you up on some specific things over time, give you objective feedback that you're going to do whatever you want to do with, right? Like, I can't make you change or anything like that. It's up to you. So I feel like this is a good discussion topic. So finding a therapist is a very hard thing to do right now. It is not easy. So I have seen professionally, and so I have been told, and so I routinely hear from folks, it is almost impossible. Therapists have month-long wait lists. Any private practice therapist that is worth their salt has a wait list right now. So there's the first thing that you need to think, at least around here. Maybe it's different in different places, but it's in Maine, it is very hard to find a therapist right now. I think there's a lot of reasons for that I won't bore you with, but the reality is it is very hard to find a therapist right now. So thinking ahead and being proactive is a good play. I will tell you there are some things that will be helpful in that regard. So if you called a therapist's office and said you wanted to get in for an appointment to see them, then you said you were private pay, self-pay, that'll get you up the list, I suspect. Why is that? Because the therapist doesn't have to deal with insurance. That is, insurance is the bane of a therapist's existence. It is what keeps a lot of therapists from doing private practice. I know currently, my small private practice is basically fee for service only. I am credentialed with a handful of insurance companies in Maine, but I'm not currently actively working with insurance companies because you've got a bill and you either got to take all the time to do it yourself and they don't make it easy, or you got to pay somebody else to do it. So that's either a time expense or a literal expense in terms of paying somebody to do it. It's kind of a big deal. So if you are someone that is able to pay out of pocket, and I know that's a big lift, right? I mean, depending on the therapist, I mean, you're probably looking at anywhere from $80 to $200 an hour. That is not, you know, that's not chump change for most people. So it's a big lift. But most people, if you do that, they'll give you receipts, and you could then submit the receipts for payment through your insurance company, and you can get reimbursed directly. So it kind of puts the burden on you, not the therapist, which is a very attractive feature for the therapist. And, you know, right as I write this, it's sort of like it's a seller's market for houses here in Maine. People are getting absurd prices for their houses, and they're lasting 2 days on the market. And it's a seller's market right now. It's a therapist's market too. In a lot of ways, it's a good time to be a therapist, I guess. So it's a therapist market. So you just have to think about that when you're going into it, and understand that if you're willing to kind of take that approach to it a little bit, it might help smooth things off a little bit. I will caution you, these, like, maybe you've seen commercials or you've heard of like BetterHelp and other agencies like that. So this isn't a hack on BetterHelp. But there's a lot of agencies, big, like, national for-profit corporations, and I have nothing against a for-profit corporation, by the way, just for the record. Sometimes they're better than nonprofits. And they'll be more straightforward with you about, hey, like, this is a business. We're trying to make money. We want to provide you with a service. We're trying to make money, too. Like, it's a exchange of, you know, money for services. I have nothing wrong with that. So there are these agencies out there right now that are doing this where you pay like a monthly fee and you just can access a clinician whenever you want. And you can change clinicians like at the drop of a hat. Anytime you want to, you can make a change. We'll come back to that and talk about that in a bit probably. But so the way that works, because I've sort of looked into these a little bit just because I was like, how are they doing this? What's that all about? So the way that works is the clinician gets paid based on how much time and energy they spend with you. So you pay a monthly fee. I actually don't know what it is. It can't be an insignificant number. And the more you can text, you can do video conference calls, all of that with your clinician. And the clinician gets paid more the more time they spend with you, the more they interact with you. I'm not sure that that's the best way to do this. I'm just not sure that that's the best way to do this. But it is an option that is available to people. And apparently, they're being fairly successful. And I think, you know, people that are having a hard time finding a clinician that have the means to pay for a service like that out of pocket, because I don't believe that insurance is a factor in those things. You may be able to submit for reimbursement on your end, but they're not taking insurance. It's a private pay kind of thing. I would be leery about that. Any clinician that's financially incentivized to keep you talking for no reason other than to keep you talking, like, I don't know, that just does not set well with me. So as a clinician, my job, and as I see it, is to be done with you as quickly as possible. Not because I don't want to, you know, continue the relationship as long as you want to continue it. But if we talk every week for 5 years about the same stuff, you're probably not getting better. And the research seems to be like that is the way that therapy was done in the very beginning. You know, sit on the couch, lay back, tell me about your father, and do this whole psychoanalyst thing. So first of all, most clinicians are not trained that way anymore. And my understanding is that's because there's no research that says that stuff works. And it's just not, it's not fiscally or financially responsible, right? Like, I'm not gonna milk you for hundreds of dollars a month for years and years and years, especially right now, right? Like, if I'm an outpatient clinician, I've got a shingle hanging somewhere, I have no shortage of referrals. If I discharge you tomorrow, I'm intaking a new person the next day. So that is, I want to be helpful. And not every therapist maybe has this mindset, right? But if you come and see me for 6 months or 9 months or a year and like we're good, that's probably a win for both of us, is kind of how I'm looking at it. I want to help you. And that's what most people need, right? For therapeutic support, your average, fairly well-functioning Joe or Jane, that's what they need. You're tripping over something, you're having a hard time, you need a minute, you need some support, some encouragement, some coaching, some tweaking, right? That's what you need. So that's what you're looking for, that's what I want to give you. So I think, you know, a clinician that wants to keep you around for years at a time, probably not who you're looking for. So I would be wary of that, like, online subscription model kind of thing. I'd be wary about that. I would be wary about clinicians that want to keep you around forever. You also need to give some thought to, you know, do you want to talk to a male or a female, or does it matter, right? Like, I'm not sure. I think it depends on what it is that you're looking for. Because there's, you know, I am not of the mindset that there is no difference between men and women. There are differences between men and women, and I think they're good. And, you know, there might be some things that if I was going to go see a clinician, I might want to talk to a female about. But there's probably some things that if I was going to go see a clinician, I would want to talk with a male clinician about. So that's something that you need to think about, male, female, and, you know, how picky are you able and willing to be about that? Can't find somebody, but you can get in with, you know, Susie and your crunch for time, and, you know, maybe that's the right play. It really shouldn't matter. It's more about preference and comfort. And, you know, a good therapist is not going to take any offense to that. A good therapist is going to be cool with meeting your needs as best as they can. And that makes me think about fit. Fit is super important. There's research studies that were done, I think in the 90s, but it doesn't really matter when they were done, that 80% of therapeutic outcomes with a clinician is about the relationship and the connectedness. So if you come in my office and sit down and you're just like, yeah, I don't like this guy, he's gruff, he's too matter of fact, he's not touchy-feely enough for me, then that's probably not going to be a good fit. Because if that's what you're looking for, rainbows, butterflies, Birkenstocks, you know, touchy-feely, like, that's not me. So that's probably not going to be a good fit. Maybe we shouldn't work together. I have some obligation to point that out to you as well, but the burden is on me to try to navigate that and figure that out. But if you're not feeling if you're not feeling it, we should talk about that. Now, I will say this. I would never encourage anybody to walk in for, like, your intake session. So that that first session is a bad time, a bad way to judge what that relationship is going to look like. There are boxes there's paperwork that's got to get filled out. There's boxes that have to get checked. The clinicians have to do, like, kind of this, like, assessment process during the first session or two. And that's not what it's going to feel like. So what I always say to people when they ask me is, hey, if you're going to meet with a clinician and you're fretting over what the relationship, and you're worried about what the relationship looks like, you really got to give it 4 to 6 sessions for a whole bunch of reasons. So that would be my ask. You know, if a client came in and met with me for day one and, you know, we did that intake session kind of thing and they were like, yeah, I don't know if this is a good fit. And unless there was something like horrifically frightening to me about the person, I would say, well, you know, time out. Now, if I was professionally like frightened by the person in some way, like I just like this just felt like it was going to be a train wreck from start to finish, then I might be like, you know what? You're right. I don't think this is going to be a good fit. So I might take that opportunity to get out of Dodge. But generally speaking, what you probably ought to do is say, hey, you know, like, let's give this like 4 to 6 sessions. Let's see how the fit is. Let's see how it goes. You know, after a month, 2 months, if you're not feeling it, I'll try and help you find somebody else. Now, that's going to be hard right now. It's not an easy lift to just bounce from clinician to clinician. So I think people have to think about that. You might need to be a little more patient with the process than what you might be in other circumstances. But I want it to be a good fit. But neither one of us are going to know that after the first like 2 sessions. So come, give it a shot, feel it out. But if you said to me, you know, we're 6-8 sessions in and you said to me, I'm just not feeling this, I am not going to take that personally. That's a problem if a clinician does, and I have met and worked with plenty who would take that personally. It's not personal. It's about fit. Do you feel comfortable? If you've given it a shot, if you're a client that's seeking this service out on your own and you're not, there's like nothing mandating you to be there or anything like that, which happens sometimes. If you've got external factors that say you don't get to choose, in a lot of my career, I worked with clients who had no say in whether or not they worked with me or not. But I always tried to make them feel like they had some say, because there's other, you know, I wasn't the only shop in town, so they could, you know, if they wanted to try somebody else out, I would try to make that happen for them. But usually we figured it out and made it work. And that's nice when the motivation is there to do that. But give it some time, work through it, see how it feels. If it doesn't feel good after, say, like, you know, 4 to 8 sessions, 4 to 6 sessions, then it's probably time to make a change at that point. You know, one other thing you might want to think a little bit about, and again, you know, when you can be picky, this makes more sense. But when you can't be picky, like right now, you cannot be picky. So in Maine, there's 2 kinds of clinicians that you could go see. There's master level clinicians and there's PhD level clinicians. There are not many PhD clinicians that I'm aware of that just kind of hang a shingle and do, but they're out there for sure. And, you know, depending on my issue, my need, I might choose that path potentially. Like, you know, if I was having a really, really hard time with something and I thought I needed to go see a therapist, I might opt for a PhD clinician as opposed to a master's level clinician. But it would depend, right? Like if I was looking for, you know, relationship stuff, or just I knew this was a quick thing that I was tripping over and it wasn't like a long-standing issue, maybe I had some minor depression stuff or whatever, you know, I'd probably be fine with an MSW or a master's level clinician. So there's two different kinds. There's MSWs and there's masters in counseling clinicians in Maine. And similar sorts of things out there too. There's LMFTs, licensed marriage and family therapists. So they're not, anybody that is one of those is not going to like. The only way I would go see one of those is if I was going for couples counseling. I would not go see them for anything else. And that's a bias that I have. And I'm sure that some people be offended by what I just said, but I would not go see an LMFT for anything other than couples or relationship sort of counseling. But you could do that if you wanted to too. It's another option. So you want to be thinking about, you know, who do you want to see? For most people, and for like adolescents, kids, master's level clinician is fine. But just something to think about, you know, what's the difference between a master's level clinician and a PhD level clinician? Well, a couple more years of school. And there's a few things that they can do that we can't from a assessment standpoint and diagnostic standpoint, but the practical applications of that for most people are there aren't any. So I don't think I would trip over that too much. I think I would, if I was going to go seek out counseling, I think I would want to go see somebody that knows more than me. And, maybe I'm tripping over my ego there a little bit, but, and I'm not sure that they do, right? They get more academic training. They don't get more clinical training necessarily. So I suspect there are good master's level clinicians that are just as, if not better than many PhD clinicians. So, I don't think I would trip over that too much if I was you, but it's worth thinking about. Other things to think about are what kind of models do they use? And if you ask a clinician that question, they should have an answer for you. And it might be, if you ask me and I was being completely honest, I'd have multiple answers for you. Then it would sort of boil down to it depends on who I'm working with and what the goal is and what the needs are and how the person presents. I'm going to take my course of action based off of how you're presenting. So if you're super unmotivated, kind of doing this woe is me kind of thing, like I'm going to take one direction with you. But if you're a highly motivated, getting after it kind of person, I'm taking a different direction with you. If you're coming to me with acute or chronic trauma related symptoms, I'm going in a different direction with you. So, I think that depends, but they should be able to give you some kind of answer that sort of makes sense. And just, I think that one thing that for me is kind of a specialty, if you will, something to really, it's trauma related stuff. If you're looking for, let's say you have, and there's a difference between what I call acute trauma and chronic trauma. So acute would be, I got in a really bad car accident and I have some lingering trauma symptoms from that I want to kind of put to bed. Okay, cool. We can do that. And that's acute versus chronic. My mother and father were alcoholic drug addicts, beat the tar out of me from the time I was like 3 till the time I was 13. I was sexually abused. I bounced from foster home to foster home. X, Y, and Z, right? Like that's chronic trauma. Those are very different things. And one is a lot easier to deal with than the other. The acute trauma, obviously. Right. So those are things to think about. If you're somebody that's wrestling with trauma stuff, like you want somebody that has some expertise in trauma. And there's different, there's just kind of general cognitive behavioral therapy with a trauma focus. Then there's something called trauma focused cognitive behavioral therapy. Really great for the acute type stuff. Not so great for the more chronic type stuff. Therapists will talk about mindfulness training and that kind of thing. People will throw out terms like dialectical behavior therapy, DBT. Those are all good things depending. EMDR is a really, if you're dealing with some trauma stuff, especially if you don't really want to talk about it, like sexual abuse type stuff is a really good example for that. So if that's something that you're wrestling with, EMDR is maybe a really good option. So finding a clinician that's trained in that, which is increasingly easy to do. Those are some good things to think about. So just, what are you looking to accomplish, and does this person have any expertise in your particular area? A good therapist is a good therapist, really, regardless of what the issues are, and a crappy therapist is a crappy therapist, regardless of what the issues are. So it is what it is. So you can feel that out for yourself. I will speak in a, I've mentioned before that most therapists think they're awesome, right? So if you ask them, just They'll tell you, ask them if they're awesome, and they'll say, "Oh yeah, I'm awesome." Like we're an arrogant bunch of people professionally. That's not that it happens to be my opinion, but there's also some interesting research that backs it up that we just think we're awesome. And the reality is we're probably not as awesome as we think we are. And a lot of us have pretty whacked out personal lives and that kind of thing. So, you know, we're not perfect. We're not up on a pedestal. So don't look at us that way, because we're not. But we do have some training and some experience that can be helpful for a lot of things and for a lot of people. And, you know, that's what most of us want to do, is be helpful. You know, and the last thing I wanted to talk about as far as what to bring to therapy with you and what to think about is just your mindset is the biggest thing. If you have a crappy attitude and you think you're coming to therapy and I'm just going to fix you, that ain't how it works. It's just not how it works. You're going to fix you. I'm going to coach you. And that is a great way to look at it. I love that notion of coaching, feedback. I am going to ask you to engage in some deliberate practice to change your thoughts, your feelings, your behaviors. It can be done. I'm going to ask you to do that. If you don't want that, that's going to be a problem, because why else are you there? So your mindset, like, and you are able to control that. It might be hard at first, but you need to come with an attitude that is reflective of change and a willingness to work. And if the clinician you're working with gives you homework, do it. If the clinician you're working with asks you to reflect on some stuff, do some journaling, write some stuff down, do it. You will get out of this what you put into it. If you think you're going to go and sit in an office for an hour a week, and that is all that is going to come from it, you're not going to get better. You're just wasting time. You are burning daylight, okay? You need to be actively and deliberately kicking this stuff around, working on it, thinking about it, practicing it, trying things out all the time. That's how you change. That's how you get better. You don't make progress on a workout program by going to the gym once a month. You don't make progress on a diet by being deliberate with your food once a month. That's not how any of that stuff works. Therapy, when it comes to emotional and cognitive stuff, it's all the same. It's what you put into it is what you're going to get out of it. And if you come with an attitude that I'm going to fix you, or therapist Susie is going to fix you, that's not the right way to look at it. And that's how a lot of people come to therapy. And I know, like, usually you're there because things aren't going great. You're desperate. You're looking for help. Some people are a little more proactive about it than that. But a lot of people take a reactive approach to therapy. Like, things are going really bad in one area, so I feel like I've got to make a desperate move, and I've got to do this thing now. And, you know, my advice would be, don't let it get to that point. Be more proactive about it. And if you need to go talk to somebody, go talk to somebody. But don't be reactive. You're never best in a reactive position. But bring a good attitude. Bring an attitude that you're going to work, and that you've got an open mind, and you want to make some changes. Your mindset is everything. I think the other thing I want to throw out is, you know, a lot of people are doing telehealth stuff nowadays, and that gives you and the clinician a ton of flexibility. Now, would I say that doing a Zoom session with somebody is as good as doing an in-person session? I guess I would say no, if I'm being completely honest. But I don't think you're losing much. I do a ton of supervision and consultation through Zoom, and at this point, I don't feel like I'm losing much. And what I gain in time, so what I mean, like travel time and that kind of thing, it is probably worth the offset of what I lose. So it's going to be, you know, if you're doing a Zoom session with somebody, like coaching session, therapy session, whatever, you don't have to go anywhere. You're there, right? You don't have to travel. The clinician doesn't have to travel. It also cuts down on the clinician's overhead too. It's really easy for me to do that stuff from my home office, as opposed to having to rent a facility down in Augusta or whatever, right? Like, it's just easy to do that. I have a coaching consulting client that I work with. We usually meet Saturday mornings. Like, I wouldn't do that if I had to go, you know, if I had to drive 45 minutes to get to Augusta and set up shop in my, like, I wouldn't do that probably, but I will do it because at 7 o'clock she pops on, we talk for an hour and that's the end of it. Like, it's super convenient and handy. So, I mean, I was very slow to warm up to the Zoom stuff in the beginning, but I'm really taken to it now. And I think the convenience and flexibility that affords everybody, because scheduling's hard, right? Like, you probably have a job, so you don't want to, it is hard for you to be somewhere at 10 o'clock on a Thursday morning, right? Like, that's not easy for you to get out of work to go do that. It's a little bit easier if you can hop on a Zoom. You don't have to drive anywhere. Maybe you've got a job where you're able to do that. Or it is a little bit easier if you've got a quiet place in your house where you can meet and not have anybody bothering you for an hour in an evening on a Tuesday night or whatever, right? Like, the Zoom stuff allows me to be so much more flexible with my schedule to meet people's needs. Because I can work from home, and I've got a private, quiet place, so, you know, confidentiality is not an issue, but I can work from home, see clients, do consultation stuff, and get done, and instead of driving 45 minutes to get back home to see my family, I just go downstairs, and there they are. So it is a huge convenience thing, and I, you know, maybe it's, if you're someone that's got to have an in-person experience, then, you know, find that. But I'm increasingly open to the Zoom type stuff, and I would encourage you to be too. It's going to open up a lot of options for you that are probably, the juice is probably worth the squeeze on that. So those are my thoughts about that. I don't know, you know, if you're probably not therapist shopping at this point, so maybe this conversation was a waste of time for you, but I get asked so much about stuff like this, so I figured it was a good topic to touch on, given, well, I'm a therapist, so I have some thoughts about it, and you don't have to agree with any or all of them, but they're mine, so there they are. I hope that is helpful. Maybe you know somebody that's looking to make a connection with a clinician or something like that, and recommend that they listen to this section of the podcast. Maybe they'll think it's helpful. I don't know. Those are my thoughts. So anyway, that's all I've got for today. I appreciate you bearing with my gruffness and my coldness. I coughed and hacked and sneezed all the way through this. Hopefully, I'm going to be able to edit it all out. But if I miss some of it, I apologize in advance because it was pretty bad at times. Thanks for bearing with me. Thanks for listening. Keep sharing the show. I really appreciate that. That is for sure the most helpful thing you can do, is share the show. Keep the listens coming. Connect with us if you're into the Instagram thing. A Commitment to Excellence is a Facebook group. A Commitment to Excellence. It's my personal stuff on the gram. I appreciate you. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.